In 1868, Edouard Manet and his wife Suzanne sat for a portrait done by Edouard's friend and fellow painter Edgar Degas. And not long after it was painted, Manet took a knife and stabbed the canvas through the image of his wife. The slashing led to a brief falling out between the two painters, and although they remained friends, things were never quite the same. In The Art of Rivalry, Four Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art, Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic Sebastian Smead looks at the complex and intimate relationships between four pairs of artists, Degas and Monet, Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon, Henri Matisse and Pablo Picasso, and Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning. The book is published by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought Sebastian Smead to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You write that there is an intimacy in art history that textbooks ignore. What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess I meant that, you know, when we're taught art history, if we are, or when we go to museums, we're often sort of taught a fairly sort of formal progression of things, a narrative that tells you how art developed from this to that, you know, the Renaissance to the Baroque, or Fauvism to Cubism.
One of my teachers, Ad Reinhardt, used to say art comes from art.
Right, I think that's true. And from artists, of course, you know, and that's the aspect I was drawn to here, because I felt that they must be intermeshed. You know, relationships between artists, which can be incredibly complex, often difficult to talk about. I mean, it does involve some speculation, it involves a lot of unknowns, but I do feel that the psychodynamics of these very crucial relationships play an enormously important role in the way art develops.
And we're talking about eight male artists. There have been relationships between men and women, for example, Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, Rodin, and Camille Claudel, Willem and Elaine de Kooning, and Pollock and Lee Krasner.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, some of those play a role in the book that I've told. I chose these particular artists for reasons that were, I guess, personal to me partly, but also because I felt there was a pattern in each of these relationships, which I didn't really see elsewhere. And you're absolutely right. There are some key relationships between those artists you mentioned. I think, you know, I would also add Bert Morisot and Manet. I would add Mary Cassatt and Degas. Mm-hmm. There are so many, Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz. But in each of those cases, there's a sort of extra, you know, sexual dynamic, if you like, and a gender dynamic that speaks to the way gender is structured within society. And they're all absolutely fascinating. I think there'll be many more relationships, even between women artists, as, you know, as we go forward. It's going to be fantastic as we find out the juicy stuff about artists like, you know, Dana Schutz and Nicole Eisenman and Lisa Yuskavage and John Curran. But there were very particular reasons why I was interested in these four relationships.
And you've also focused just on modern artists. Were there similar kinds of rivalries in the past? I'd imagine there were.
Well, I think they were, absolutely. But I really, you know, and one thinks of the great rivalries in the Renaissance, you know, Michelangelo and Leonardo and Raphael, Titian, Tintoretto, Veronese. And in the 19th century, I think the classic rivalry was between the neoclassicist Ingres and the romanticist Delacroix. That's sort of almost the most famous rivalry of that period. But in each of those cases, I felt, you know, we talk about it in a way that's about these sort of macho guys slugging it out, you know, to the death. And it's a very competitive relationship. And in the relationships I was interested in, I felt something was different. There was this intimacy, this volatility, and they were friends. There was an incredible closeness between each of these people.
Don't present this in chronological order. You begin with Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon. Were you being purposely unchronological?
I guess so. You know, I think we argued a little bit about the order, and there's no particular rhyme or reason to it. There was a personal aspect. You know, the one artist among all of these that I was lucky to know was Lucian Freud, and it was getting to know him in London over a period of 4 or 5 years I began to learn about his relationship with Francis Bacon. I'd been very afraid to even raise the subject because, you know, they had this famous falling out, and one was told that, you know, it was dangerous even to raise the subject. But eventually I did, and what sort of became apparent to me was that it was incredibly complex, and I became fascinated in the whole subject through that.
In discussions of this sort, taste always comes up, and I've wondered, does anyone who isn't British think that these two artists are on the same level as Degas, Manet, Picasso, Matisse, de Kooning, or Pollock, all of whom were incredibly influential on the artists who followed?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true that Freud, who is, you know, was easily the most famous British artist, you know, alive after Bacon's death, certainly during the time I knew him. He's not nearly as well known here. And but to answer your question, I think that people throughout Europe and in my native country, Australia, many great critics, even in the States, people like John Russell, Michael Kimmelman, all sort of think that Freud's a very important artist. But I think he is more controversial than some of the others, for sure.
I'm speaking with Sebastian Smee, and the book we're discussing is The Art of Rivalry, Four Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art. It is published by Random House. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You call the friendship of Bacon and Freud intense but asymmetrical.
Yeah, I think that's the case, and it applies to some of the others too. But Bacon was older. He was much better known. People were more excited about him at the time that he and Freud met. And by the way, in each case in these chapters, I really focus on the early period in their relationship when they were making their breakthroughs. But there's no doubt that Bacon was in advance of Freud at that time.
Their work was quite different in intention. Aren't artists usually drawn to kindred spirits?
Yeah, I think so, although they were kindred spirits in some senses. They were interested in the human figure. They were interested in portraiture. And they were interested in getting paint to communicate a kind of intensity, and indeed figurative imagery to communicate this new intensity that was peculiarly modern. And I think that where in America there was a move towards abstraction, the better-known British artists really did sort of stick to the figure in the way that Matisse and Picasso did as well, by the way.
Although in the case of Bacon, there's a very surreal aspect to the work, and that's not present in Freud's work.
No, that's right. And they did have very different visions of the relationship between, if you like, truth and appearances.
The artist and the sitter.
Yes, indeed. And you know, for instance, that's a great point. I mean, Bacon only wanted to paint people from photographs. He didn't want the sitter in the room. But Freud was determined to keep the sitter in the room, and his paintings sort of took place over weeks and months, and that was a key difference. But it was, again, about that different feeling for truth.
Including a little bit of messiness. I once had his daughter on the show, and she talked about all the scandal of having posed for her father in the nude when she was just a kid.
Right, right. I remember he was asked about that. Didn't he feel it was strange to do that? And he said, my daughters have nothing to be ashamed of.
You recount a scene when Lucian Freud had to decline a wedding invitation for an odd reason.
Yes,
what happened?
Well, it was just rather complicated. He had a famously complex love life, and in the early days, he had some relationships with men as well, and I think that dynamic may have played into his relationship with Bacon as well.
Because Bacon was gay.
Yes, Bacon was gay, and Freud was sort of, you know, bisexual a little bit in those early days. At this wedding that he was, you know, Freud at the time was married and had a child, but he had had a former lover, and then had had apparently a brief fling with her son, who was a lot, you know, the original lover was a lot older and the son was more his age. And then he'd had an affair with the woman who was then getting married to the son. I mean, it's so, you have to write it down. It's impossible to communicate, but it was very involved. And
so
for those reasons,
the groom and the bride.
Exactly. And for those reasons, he felt it probably wasn't appropriate to turn up.
Why did Freud paint a portrait of Bacon? Did Bacon want to be painted?
He agreed to it. I think Freud wanted a chance to spend intense and intimate time with him and to get to know him better. He says, you know, it sounds funny, but he felt that he didn't know him that well. But he was incredibly affected by his personality and his charisma, his sense of risk and urgency, his charm and his extroverted nature. And you know, that's something that applies to all the relationships. You have one of the pair who is kind of stuck and perhaps a little introverted, and the other comes along and sort of energizes things and shows them a way forward, which hadn't seemed possible before. And it's not only in artistic terms, but I think in terms of personality and temperament.
And well, there's usually a slight age discrepancy, or in this case, a large age discrepancy. What did Bacon think of the portrait?
I think that he thought it was terrific. Although we don't, I'm assuming that he never said, he never put anything on record. Freud sort of thinks that I once asked him, you know, what do you think Bacon thought of your work? And he said, I'm not sure. I don't think he was particularly interested. For him, it, you know, the relationship was more about Freud's personality, which was very attractive to him, but less about the art. So there was this asymmetry.
And then the story of the portrait itself takes on a life of its own.
Yes. So many years later, in fact, just before the time when I got to know Freud in 1988, the picture was on display. It's a tiny picture, the size of a pocket paperback. It was on display in a gallery in Berlin, and it was stolen from the walls of the gallery. And years later, there was a retrospective of Freud coming up, about to be mounted in London at Tate Britain. And Freud naturally wanted to have this picture back. He felt it was a key work, which indeed it was in his career. And they decided to create a wanted poster, you know, in the old-fashioned Western style, offering a reward of, I think, 300,000 Deutschmark it was at the time. And they put this poster up all around Berlin, and they put it in magazines and so on. It was never recovered, and it still hasn't been, so it's terribly sad. But what was interesting to me, and I guess this is what triggered the whole thing, is that I saw that poster outside Freud's studio. He kept it there as the first thing he saw as he came into his studio each day.
Your subtitle is Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art. Is there a betrayal here?
Yeah, I felt that there were betrayals in each case of various kinds. And you know, that aspect of competitiveness came through. I mean, I think there was a complicated kind of betrayal between Bacon and Freud to do with love life. There was, you know, in the case of de Kooning and Pollock, I mean, this sort of melodramatic, almost embarrassing thing of de Kooning taking as his girlfriend Pollock's lover, the one who'd survived the terrible car crash.
Who was once a guest on the show, by the way.
Right, how extraordinary. I'll have to go back and listen to that. But I think that, you know, also the betrayal is there in the actual artworks. A sense of, you know, you fall under the spell of someone, you lose yourself to some degree to that person, but then you have to push away, you have to kick against them and no longer be their protege in any sense. And that's something that plays out in each of these relationships.
You write that Degas, like Freud, was instinctively drawn to the unknown aspects of people.
Yes, and I think that's true. It's a fascinating change in modern portraiture. It's less and less this idea that, you know, you can look at the eyes of a subject and see through to their soul, you know, that cliche. They begin to realize that there is so much about people that's unknowable. Perhaps, you know, Sigmund Freud, Lucian's grandfather, you know, played a big role here, and it was certainly a big subject in literature at the time, that there was this great well of unknowability. And I think that Degas really embraced that in his portraiture, but partly through the influence of Manet.
But he begins as an accepted artist. Manet had real problems when he started, didn't he?
He sure did. I mean, he became instantly notorious in the early 1860s with those scandalous pictures, the Olympia and the Luncheon on the Grass.
But he was seen as an underachieving son by his parents.
Yes, yes. Both Degas and Manet, unlike most of the other Impressionists, were well-born and affluent, and they were expected to go into the law and chose not to.
You say that Manet's realism was a counterfeit realism. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at those pictures in the 1860s, they're not particularly realistic. They show people in dress-up costumes, you know, dressed as toreadors or various other things, always in costume. And there's a playfulness in this, I think, you know, and there's a lot that's kind of inexplicable about those famous pictures like Luncheon on the Grass. Why are there sort of two clothed men surrounding a naked woman in a picnic situation? I mean, that
because he is kind of making reference to a famous painting of the past.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And he was, so it was, whether it was a Venetian painter or whether it was a Spanish painter, he was kind of commenting on the history of art in a way that Picasso did many years later.
He absolutely was. You couldn't be more correct. And yet there's this sort of lifelikeness in his pictures as well that made people sort of expect there to be an element of truth to appearances there.
Well, interestingly, art historians have generally described Manet as a major figure in the transition from realism to impressionism, While Degas, who's usually described as one of the founders of Impressionism, preferred to be called a realist.
Yeah, no, it's all a bit sort of contradictory in a way. I think Degas was a realist and in a way stayed a realist. He changed he changed his sort of sensibility or what he was interested in, but he did have that fidelity to appearances, perhaps partly because he was such a talented draftsman. I think Manet was more playful and influenced by poetry, for instance. Baudelaire was a huge influence on his work.
And that was another friendship that got complicated.
Very complicated, but it was a key relationship in Manet's life. And if you look at, you know, there's a painting he did. It's at the Met here in New York that shows Baudelaire's funeral from a distance. And there's a real melancholy to it because I think Baudelaire really did mean so much to him.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the first meeting between Manet and Degas and also look at the relationship between Pollock and de Kooning and Matisse and Picasso, the generally for much of the 20th century considered the two great rivals of modern art until Duchamp wound up winning that rivalry. The art of rivalry for friendships, betrayals, and breakthroughs in modern art is Sebastian Smee's new book. It is published by Random House. Stay with us for more. We are back with Sebastian Smee. His book, The Art of Rivalry, Four Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art, published by Random House. So how did Manet and Degas meet? They were just 2 years apart.
That's right.
Manet was 2 years older than
that's
Degas.
That's right, yeah. And they met in the Louvre. Degas was etching in front of a painting then believed to be by Velázquez. It's since sort of been attributed to someone else, I think. But he was there etching away. And Manet, who was both a lover of Velázquez and all things Spanish and someone who was really interested in etching at the time, dared to come up to the slightly younger Degas and say, look, you know, actually, I'm not sure you're quite doing it right. Why don't you try this? We don't know the details. We don't know exactly what he said, but it's a funny encounter. And, you know, Degas was a rather prickly sort of person and might easily have taken it the wrong way, but I think it's a testament to Manet's legendary charm and general sort of congeniality that he took the advice and thanked him and said that, you know, he would be forever indebted to him, and that was the beginning of the friendship.
Degas never married. How did he feel about marriage and women? I mean, he once said, art is not a legitimate love. One does not marry it, one rapes it.
Right, yes.
I mean, I'm Degas, not sure anybody would say that today.
I don't think they would either. Degas' attitudes to marriage and to women generally have been the subject of lots of controversy and lots of argument.
He's been described as a misogynist.
Yeah, that's right. And perhaps he was, but I think it was probably more complicated than that. He had many close female friends who were very smart, very talented, and he supported them, people like Mary Cassatt and many others. But he did believe that you couldn't be a great artist and be married at the same time. So there was Manet married, and in a rather complex sort of marriage, which had sort of been forced on him by the fact that he got a woman pregnant, the piano teacher in his family's household. But they were close, and it wasn't a disaster of a marriage by any stretch. But I think that it was also a source of some shame and complication in Manet's life. He had to keep aspects of it secret. The son, Léon, was passed off as either a godson or a nephew. And it was all very complicated. So I think Degas was sort of looking on at this and perhaps, you know, Manet felt uncomfortable with Degas' skeptical scrutiny.
And the image opens up some of that for discussion. It's Manet kind of lazing around where Suzanne is at the piano.
Right.
After that affair with the piano teacher, that almost takes on some kind of symbolism. But they agreed to sit for the portrait. And then do we know why Manet slashed the face of the portrait of his wife? I always assumed that it was because he was angry with her and that was a way of getting back at her.
Well, some people have said that, and that's perfectly plausible, and others have said that he didn't like the fact that Degas had made his wife look uglier than she was. I mean, you know, there's no way we can know for sure.
Own portrait of her as a corrective.
Yeah, yeah. and many others of her as well, and he made her look lovely. But, you know, I think my sort of feeling was that at this point, for many reasons, Degas was just getting under Manet's skin, and particularly portraying his own marriage as perhaps a sort of failed marriage. There is Manet sort of sitting slumped in the couch, and it's possible he's lost in reverie and delighting in the music, but he also looks rather bored and disaffected.
You write that Matisse and Picasso met during crucial times in both of their careers. How did they meet?
So it was a crucial time. It was very early on. They met, we think, at the Steins, Gertrude and Leo Stein.
Were they aware of each other before they met?
Yes, they were. Both had sort of had relations with the dealer Ambroise Vollard and knew of each other through the Steins already. So the Steins orchestrated their meeting. They, you know, were supporting each of them independently. It all happened very quickly, though, in the space of 6 months or a year, and finally they met, and I start the chapter with an account of you know, the Steins taking Matisse and his daughter Marguerite to Picasso's studio up in Montmartre.
Had Picasso already started painting in a Cubist manner?
No. So this is well before then. And
so Matisse was more of the modernist than Picasso.
Oh, he was way ahead of Picasso, there's no doubt. And I think this was galling to Picasso, who'd, of course, come from Spain, where he'd been celebrated by everyone who knew him for his amazing, prodigious skill. But there he is, arriving in Paris, and there's this sort of bespectacled, slightly older man who everyone is talking about, who's doing far more radical things than Picasso's even conceived of. And I think, you know, as they got to know each other and had to socialize at the Steins, and actually I think did become quite friendly, it was nonetheless really galling to Picasso to have to sort of deal with his, you know, the fact that Matisse was preeminent.
You describe their influence on each other as a drama unlike any in the story of modern art, and a fight that Matisse, for a surprisingly long time, doesn't seem to be to have quite registered he was even in.
Yeah.
That's because he was already the established artist.
I think that's right. You know,
and under attack for being a fauve and all of those other things.
He was getting it from all sides in a way that was sort of reminiscent of the way Manet had got so much criticism from the public and from critics in 1860. So I think that he liked the idea of Picasso almost as a kind of protege, someone he could have an influence on. And when, you know, that's a dynamic in all these stories too, that when someone who is clearly very talented and intelligent shows in their work the influence of you, it helps to affirm what you're doing, even if everyone else is saying that what you're doing is kind of crazy, which was what was going on for Matisse at the time.
What effect did Matisse's blue nude memory of Biskra have on Picasso? Was that an inspiration for Les Demoiselles?
Yeah, absolutely. And people like John Richardson, the wonderful Picasso biographer, and Hilary Sperling, the Matisse biographer, have written very well about this. You know, that picture was very distorted, very strange. And even today, really, to look at, I think quite strange for us. But for Picasso, I mean, the extraordinary thing about this period is that one by one, he takes each of the major influences on Matisse, the things that have been most dear to Matisse's heart, Cézanne, African art, the art of his own children, and this idea of deformation, you know, changing, distorting the image. One by one, Picasso takes these and puts them all together and comes up with the famous Demoiselle d'Avignon, which of course hangs at MoMA, which was such a radical breakthrough.
Did Matisse ever try his hand at Cubism?
Yes, he did. So at first, I think he was quite dismissive, and he felt that his own advances had sort of almost been parodied and mocked, and he was quite upset as well, of course, because Picasso's co-inventor of Cubism, Braque, had been sort of in his camp as a fauvist and now was switched to Picasso's. So there was a difficult few years. But I think then, partly through the Spaniard Juan Gris, Matisse had seen a lot of the merits in Cubism and was still very much admiring of Picasso. So he changed his style, and for a number of years there, through the teens, through the First World War, he was painting quite explicitly Cubist pictures.
They both lived very long lives. What happened in the 40s and 50s and 60s?
Well,
were they ever in contact with each other?
Right. So Matisse dies in 54, but all the way leading up to there, you know, you have this sort of dance of attraction and rejection, you know, pulling together and pulling apart. The influence becomes more obvious in certain times, and then it's not there at all. I mean, when at the end, so 1917, Matisse goes to Nice and paints in a way that couldn't be further from Cubism. But I'm quite convinced that he was thinking about Picasso that whole time.
The last couple are de Kooning and Pollock, and de Kooning was very influenced by Cubism. In fact, he pretty much structured all of his paintings until the later ones using Cubist rules.
Yeah, that's right.
And Pollock is totally opposite. He breaks free of the Cubist structure and begins what one critic called the art of the real, objects as paintings as objects.
Yeah, not referring to anything in the outside world. That's right. I mean, but I think that before that breakthrough into the so-called, you know, splatter painting drip painting, Pollock too was also very influenced by Picasso. There's a show right now at the MFA that puts them side by side. And by the way, de Kooning was not only influenced by Picasso, but very much by Matisse. And so a lot of artists at the time were juggling the two influences and trying to sort through them to arrive at something of their own.
And you write that they were cast as rivals throughout their careers, were they?
They were. And again, I wonder whether it would have been such a sort of notorious rivalry in that sort of macho sense, if it hadn't been for the influence of outside people. I mean, in many ways, it was their supporters and friends, lovers and wives in some cases, and perhaps above all, the critics who exaggerated this complicated relationship into a rivalry, a more oppositional kind of rivalry. So, you know, the war between the two critics, Harold Rosenberg and Clement Greenberg, became a sort of proxy war. You know, who did you support, de Kooning or Pollock? And in the same way, Gertrude Stein played a big part in making the relationship between Matisse and Picasso a very oppositional one. She divided the world into Picassoites and Matisseites.
Both de Kooning and Pollock came to New York from very different places, but they were both outsiders initially. Yeah. Do you think that that played any role in the way they approached their art? Was that a connection for
them? I do. I think it's interesting that in all these relationships, you have a sort of outsiders coming into the cosmopolitan center. So I think Manet and Degas are the only exceptions there. But with Matisse, he's come from the north of France, a very provincial town, to Paris. You've got Picasso coming from Spain. And it applies to all of them. I think it's very hard to put your finger on, isn't it? But I think a degree of ambition, of a desire for originality, all of these things play a part. And what's interesting, too, is that the key early supporters of each of these artists were often from outside as well. So the Steins in Paris were from America. You had a lot of émigrés supporting Pollock and de Kooning in those early years. And Matisse and Picasso, you know, Shukin, the Russian collector, and so on. And without those outsiders, if you like, foreigners and so on, one wonders whether they would have received any support at all.
De Kooning was a really gifted draftsman, more than Pollock.
Right, exactly. And that, again, that's the same with Degas and Manet. Degas, so gifted. De Kooning could draw like an angel. I mean, he was so talented. And for Pollock, it was a great source of insecurity. He really was not a talented draftsman at all. So he had to find a way to break through that. And he did, of course, with his drip painting.
You write that their first encounter was anything but auspicious.
Right. I'm just trying to cast back in my mind.
That Pollock was deep into one of his periods of extended binge drinking at the time.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Of course. And what's interesting, too, is that the person who introduced them was Pollock's girlfriend at the time, Lee Krasner, the wonderful, talented artist. And interestingly, she had many years before had a sort of crush on de Kooning, which never turned into anything. But she knew about him. He had this reputation, you know, for tremendous sort of authenticity and integrity on the local downtown scene. And once she discovered Pollock, she really wanted the two of them to meet. But, yeah, Pollock was terribly hungover, and perhaps there was a little bit of strutting and competitiveness. But I think they became closer later on and were very mutually admiring.
Wasn't Pollock the one who achieved the earlier success, despite the fact that de Kooning was a lot older?
Yes, that's absolutely right.
And de Kooning, was he a bit envious because he'd been around a while and was a very respected artist?
Well, that's a great question, because what's on the record is simply de Kooning saying, you know, it was great because Pollock broke the ice. He made people realize that an American artist could become a serious modernist and make it possible for all the other modernists, including de Kooning, to be noticed. But they were being pointedly ignored by everyone. And I think that de Kooning was smart enough to see that Pollock's breakthrough could benefit all of them, including him.
So, as you say, he embraced a level of spontaneity he had resisted up to then.
Yeah, he was a bit like Degas again. He was kind of stuck. He almost cultivated difficulty in his work, and he didn't want to. He didn't feel ready to show his work, despite the urging of so many others.
How were their shows? Their early shows. Pollock, I guess, was around 43 or so. His breakthrough show, De Kooning, around 48. How were they received in the press?
They were received very well in the press. What's interesting is that didn't necessarily translate to sales, so that although many were envious of all this attention that Pollock was suddenly getting, he was still on a financial knife edge, and it was tough times for both of them.
And I was told that even after he died, Lee Krasner was trying to raise some money, and she found it really hard to sell these Pollocks that now go for many, many millions of dollars.
I know. It's incredible the difference, you know, just a few decades has made, isn't it? Absolutely.
De Kooning's later work is very controversial because he had Alzheimer's, and some people see it as profound and others see it as kind of loopy.
I think many of them are just beautiful pictures. They really are. They have a ghostly, sort of haunted feeling. They're very minimal, and they really give you a feeling for... I can't help but see combinations of Matisse and of Picasso in them in a way that he hadn't really sort of synthesized so satisfyingly before.
So can we say that Pollock and De Kooning to some degree reflect the rivalry between Matisse and Pollock?
Absolutely. You know, and again, this is partly the reason why I chose these four relationships. And it's the same with Freud and Bacon and Degas and Manet. I mean, when I got to know Freud, we would often talk, and one hand would be absentmindedly caressing a Degas sculpture that he had right beside him. I mean, he was incredibly fascinated by not only Degas, but by Matisse and Picasso. And so these things kind of come around. There's a lot of reiteration.
Sebastian Smee has been the Boston Globe's art critic since 2008 and won the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism in 2011. He teaches nonfiction writing at Wellesley, and his latest book is The Art of Rivalry, Four Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.